This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies. Written and read by Jim Collins and Jerry I. Porras. Preface. This is Jim Collins, and I'd like to welcome you to this audio recording of Built to Last by me, my co-author, Jerry Porras. Jerry and I will roughly alternate chapters throughout this entire recording. I'll go first, then Jerry second, and so forth. The roots of this book are twofold. And first came a question. Like most of our best work, it was a question and a challenge from a student. Early in my teaching career at the Stanford Graduate School of Business in 1989, I faced a skeptical group of MBA students in my course in entrepreneurship and small business. And one day, a student cornered me with a challenge. "Jim, I have a problem with your entire course," she said. "You say this course is about building enduring great companies from the ground up, but you're using case examples from companies like, say, Apple Computer." Nothing against Apple Computer, but we cannot tell if Apple is going to become one of those great iconic companies. No question, we will all agree it will have been a tremendous entrepreneurial success story. But no one can yet say if it's going to attain the enduring significance of companies like IBM or GE or Johnson & Johnson. Furthermore, and at this point she thumped her finger on the desk, how do you know the company was successful because of anything you're teaching us? The company could have just been lucky. After all, if you have the Apple II in 1977 and you have the Macintosh in 1984, well, Apple could have been successful not because of its management practices, but in spite of them. Her challenge hung in the air, and she was right. Growth and early success can cover an awful lot of sins. Perhaps, unwittingly to be sure, I was just feeding my students managerial cyanide. A colleague advised upon the start of my faculty appointment that I should respond to such challenges by trying to look wise. But I was only 31 years old, and I looked just as young as the average student. So finally, after a long pause, I said simply, "That's a really good question. I'll get back to you." Little did I know that it would take 6 years of research and 325 pages of text to make good on my promise. Her challenge festered in my brain. She was right. How would you know which factors separate the few entrepreneurial success stories that become truly great companies from all the others? Why did Sam Walton's small chain of dime stores grow to become Walmart? Why did Ibuka's band of renegade entrepreneurs in a bombed-out building in downtown Tokyo in 1945, with a failed rice cooker, of all things, as its first product, rise to become Sony Corporation? Why was Thomas J. Watson Sr. able to take the small and insignificant computing, tabulating, recording company and turn it into the International Business Machines Corporation, known today as IBM? And most important, what separated these cases from others? Others that were just as lucky, or maybe even more lucky, in the early going? I had no answers. Meanwhile, just down the hall, and unbeknownst to me, the second root of this book had taken hold. My colleague Jerry Porras had spent the previous 25 years trying to answer the question of how organizations can change to make themselves healthier places to work and more successful in delivering results. As he began to piece together his life's work into an overall framework, he realized that he lacked a significant piece of the puzzle. What drives healthy and enduringly successful organizations? If you look over 100 years of history, you realize that most well-run organizations adopt most of the same basic practices and methods, and yet, very few become great. You can export the practices of democratic government all over the world, but the fact remains that some nations become great and dominant in the course of history, while others that also adopt democratic government, do not. Most universities have the same basic practices. They all learn from each other. But few rise to the stature of Harvard, Stanford, or the University of California at Berkeley. Most major newspapers have access to the same journalistic practices, yet only a few attain the influential stature of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Whether it be the Mayo Clinic, the United States Marine Corps, Habitat for Humanity, or the Salvation Army, a few select organizations rise far beyond mere success to weave themselves into the very fabric of society so that it's difficult for us to picture our world without them. With corporations, we see the same pattern. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about the principles of scientific management, the fundamentals of statistical quality control, management by objectives, Six Sigma, decentralization, re-engineering, strategic planning, and so forth. Over time, the best practices tend to spread across all major companies. And yet, some companies become truly great, while others do not, even though they all have access to the exact same best practices. The obvious question Jerry asked is, why? He came to believe that truly great organizations think of themselves in a fundamentally different way than mediocre ones. He came to see that they have a guiding philosophy, a spirit about them, a reason for being, a purpose that goes far beyond just making money. Jerry wanted to spend the final years of his academic career applying research rigor to understanding the elusive and yet somehow supremely important variables that fell into fuzzy and soft terms like vision, purpose, values, and mission. Then by serendipity, Jerry came across a short article I'd written on the role of mission in building entrepreneurial enterprises into great companies. He left me a voice message, and it went something like, I think we're interested in some of the same questions, and since we're on the same faculty, maybe we should get together to chat. I called Jerry back, we got together, and boy did we chat. In fact, it went from a chat to a debate, a vigorous debate, about whether we meant conceptually different ideas or fundamentally the same concept when we spoke about mission and purpose. I focused on mission, Jerry focused on purpose. We sounded a bit like a beer commercial going back and forth. Tastes great, less filling. And thus began a wonderful working collaboration that would eventually produce Built to Last. To Jerry's immense credit, we operated as peers, despite 2 decades of age difference, and the fact that he was a tenured full professor with an endowed chair and a stint as a Stanford academic dean, and I was a junior 31-year-old faculty member. I was fortunate at this pivotal moment in my career to have Jerry as a mentor and a colleague, as he cared more about the ultimate success of the work than about who got the credit or the top billing. When the time came to put our names on the book, we listed them in alphabetical order, Collins and Porras, not in order of seniority. I marvel at that in retrospect. Jerry and I wrestled with how we could construct a rigorous research study, how to deal with my students' challenge about luck, how to provide analytic rigor to fuzzy topics like vision and values, how to identify the variables that distinguish the truly great, how to identify the principles that separate iconic institutions, those that weave themselves into the fabric of society and change our world, from the mass of mediocrity. That's when Jerry had 2 brilliant research insights. First is the idea of applying genetic twin studies to social systems. Genetic twin studies are those fascinating research efforts where you find 2 twins separated at birth, examine their life trajectories, and then use this natural experiment to get insight into the nature versus nurture debate. The wonderful thing about studying companies is that the birth of most industries gives us at least one pair of twins, or matched pairs. Two companies born in the same era, with the same market opportunities, facing the same demographics, technology shifts, and socioeconomic trends. But when you fast forward the tape of history, 25, 50, or 100 years, some of these companies become great, while their twin brothers and sisters do not. Consider General Electric and Westinghouse. Both companies came into existence at the turn of the 20th century, born into the new industry of electrical power. Both companies had access to capital and faced a gigantic opportunity to disseminate electrical power to the masses. But by the end of the 20th century, GE and Westinghouse, despite starting in the exact same place with the exact same opportunities at the exact same moment in history, had become very different companies. GE became a true icon, perhaps the most widely admired and influential company of the 20th century. Westinghouse, while a successful company, failed to attain the same stature. Jerry's idea, and it's a wonderful insight, was that we could take this model and study a set of rigorously selected industrial twins, matched pairs, as a controlled, retrospective, natural experiment. Jerry's second key insight is that time wins. You can live off of luck for 5 or 10 years, but there's no way you're going to live off of luck for 5 or 10 decades. It's very hard to argue that the enduring success of Johnson & Johnson, founded all the way back in 1886, or Procter & Gamble, founded in 1837, more than 2 decades before the American Civil War, or Citicorp, founded in 1812, the same year Napoleon marched into Moscow, derives primarily from just being lucky. Furthermore, you're more likely to sift out the liars and the cheats. As the accounting scandals and the corporate meltdowns from 2000 to 2004 show, you can cheat your way to seeming greatness for 5 or 10 years, but there's no way you can get away with it for 50 or 100 years. Drawing upon these two methodological insights, we elected to do a match pair study over a long period of time, a whole series of industrial twins, to look at companies that had risen to that iconic stature and held it for 5 or 10 or 15 decades, and to systematically compare the history of these companies to their closest industrial twins to determine the timeless principles that separate the truly great from the mediocre. And that is what Built to Last is all about, the timeless principles. One question we've been repeatedly asked is how the Built to Last companies have fared since we completed the book. Certainly, some of the companies have struggled in the intervening years, notably Disney, Boeing, HP, and Sony. But others, such as IBM, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, GE, American Express, and Walmart, they've performed exceptionally well. Happily, the majority of the Built to Last companies demonstrated strong performance. And in fact, the combined portfolio outperformed the market, just as it had done for 7 previous decades, dating back to 1925. And this despite everything that has happened in the intervening years, from the internet bubble to 9/11. But even if this were not the case, the question of recent performance is irrelevant to the overall argument of this book. For one thing, as you'll hear in Chapter 1, the signature of a truly great company is not the absence of difficulty, but the ability to come back from difficult times even stronger than before. I remember when we published Built to Last in 1994, IBM at that time found itself in the middle of a desperate turnaround, and Jerry and I endured derision for including IBM in the book. People said to us, "They're a dinosaur. Look at the struggles they're having. How can you possibly put IBM in as a visionary company?" And yet, 10 years later, as I record this introduction, IBM has returned as one of the most significant companies in the world. Resiliency, not perfection, resiliency is the signature of greatness, be it in a person, an organization, or a nation. Furthermore, even if a few of our struggling companies fail to regain their prior greatness, and that's always possible, that fact alone, even if it happens, would not undermine the fundamental ideas we derived and built to last. Think about it this way. Suppose we studied the great UCLA basketball dynasty of the 1960s and 70s, which won 10 NCAA championships in 12 years under Coach John Wooden. Suppose also that we compared the UCLA Bruins under Wooden to a perfect match pair, another team that was in the same conference with the same opportunities, say the UC Berkeley Golden Bears. Further suppose that we repeat this analysis across a range of sports dynasties in history. The Green Bay Packers of the 1960s, in comparison to, say, the San Francisco 49ers of the same era, or the New York Yankees to the Boston Red Sox. And we develop a framework of principles about building a great dynasty. Think about this question. Is the UCLA basketball team today a great dynasty? The answer is no, not at the same level as earlier eras. Would this fact, the fact that the Bruins today are not a great dynasty, negate the principles we would learn by studying the Bruins at their best? No, of course not. The practices may have changed, but the principles of great sports dynasties would still stand, even if the UCLA Bruins ceased to live the principles that made them truly great in the first place. If we studied healthy people in contrast to unhealthy people, and we derived principles of health, such as sound sleep, a balanced diet, and moderate exercise, would it undermine these health principles if later, down the road, some of our previously healthy subjects started getting no sleep, eating poorly, and not exercising? The answer is quite clearly no. All that would say is that some members of the original study set had ceased to live the principles that made them healthy in the first place. Sleep, diet, and exercise would still hold as principles of health. Jerry and I have been blessed with a fabulous base of thoughtful readers who grasp this essential distinction between timeless principles and the list of specific companies we used to derive those principles. And that is why the book has had such an enduring success and a wide-reaching impact, enjoying more than 6 years on the Business Week bestseller list, translation into 23 languages, and sales in excess of 1 million copies. More than we could have ever dared to hope. Built to Last has lived up to its own name. Ironically, we can claim no credit for the title. Creativity often sprouts from frustration, and in 1994, our editors were frustrated in the extreme. As the publishing deadline neared, we just kept vetoing titles, from You Are the Competition to Research Results on Visionary Companies. I shudder to think what would have happened if we would have titled Built to Last, You Are the Competition. On the order of 127 titles fell by the wayside. We can't go to press without a title, our editor pushed. Well, we can't go to press without a great title, we pushed back. The situation finally escalated to the executive editor, who went home from the weekend and came back on Monday morning and dropped a 3x5 card on our editor's desk. Here, he said, see if they'll go for this. On it, he'd written the simple phrase, Built to Last. And we had our title. There's an irony here, as Built to Last is, in a sense, the wrong title. Don't get me wrong. It's a great title, it's a memorable title, and we'd still keep it. We love the title. But from the perspective of what this book is all about, it misses the mark. Built to Last is not fundamentally about building to last. After all, the comparison companies in Built to Last, the twins, also lasted. Westinghouse lasted as long as GE. And yet, while lasting, Westinghouse failed to become the same stature as GE. So we can't say that built to last is just about making something last. So then, what is built to last about? Built to last is about building something that is worthy of lasting, about building an institution or company or piece of work that makes such a distinctive impact on the world that it touches and does it with such intrinsic excellence that if it were to go away, it would leave behind an unfillable hole that could not be easily replaced by any other institution on the planet. If Disney had disappeared in the takeover fight of the early 1980s, yes, there would still be theme parks, but no one in the world could have replaced Disneyland. Implicit on every page of Built to Last is a simple question. Why on earth would you settle for creating something mediocre that does little more than just make money when you can create something outstanding that makes a lasting contribution as well? And in the end, as the evidence showed from our research, those who make a lasting contribution make more money over the long run anyway. One of the greatest misconceptions about Built to Last, one that drives me crazy, is that the book is about making things permanently fixed in time and space, unchanging, static. Nothing could be further from the truth. To be built to last, you must be built to change. Let me repeat that. To be built to last, you must be built to change. The cornerstone concept is the yin and yang dynamic of preserve the core and stimulate progress. The key word here is and. Built to Last is an and book. Continuity and change. Core values and big, hairy, audacious goals. Stability and discontinuity. Cult-like cultures and idiosyncratic people within those cultures. Consistency and innovation. Discipline. Disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought, who take disciplined action. And creativity, entrepreneurial people doing creative, experimental things. Systematic methods and experimental approaches. Meaning and achievement. Preserve the core and stimulate progress. Those who fail to grasp the and simply do not understand our work. Built to Last is at its core about relentless creative drive, about a constantly irritating and unreachable itch, about the need to do something valuable and significant for no other reason than this is what it means to be fully human. At its deepest level, this is not a business book. We're interested in social systems and what enables greatness over time. And we just so happen to get at the key principles through the lens of studying business. Finally, for those who have read Good to Great, you might be wondering how these two books, Good to Great and Built to Last, fit together. I like to think of Good to Great as the prequel to Built to Last, even though we first published Built to Last in 1994, and Good to Great not until 2001. Good to Great comes first, in logical order, and is about how to make the leap from good performance to sustained great results. Built to Last comes second, in logical order, and is about how you take a company with great results and turn it into an enduring great company of iconic stature. In other words, think about it this way. You must first go from good to great, and then go from good to great to built to last. One major difference between the two research studies is how we selected the companies. In good to great, we selected strictly on a pattern of cumulative investor returns relative to the general stock market. We used a purely financial metric. In Built to Last, on the other hand, we wanted to study companies that had transcended financial success and had made themselves into those that make a distinctive impact on their world, that gain respect and esteem from other people, and that sustained their greatness not just for 15 years, but for 50 or 100 years. To accomplish this, we used a very different model of selection than in Good to Great. We surveyed a carefully selected sample of CEOs from large and small companies. We believed that those who must compete with the visionary companies would be the most discerning judges. When we look back now, almost 15 years since the survey, it's remarkable how many of the companies still stand as significant institutions. Some may be up, others may be down. But you cannot deny that companies like IBM, Sony, GE, Merck, 3M, Johnson & Johnson, Boeing, Procter & Gamble, Walt Disney, and Walmart have forever changed the world in which we live. For good or bad, their impact is significant. The founding architects who created and built these companies left behind a legacy that can be matched by few. The question is, will you? If we were rewriting Built to Last today, we would not overturn any of the basic concepts. We certainly know more about great companies than we did in 1994, and there is certainly much that we could add. But our faith in the fundamental findings that you will learn in the coming chapters has not faded. Indeed, we are more convinced than ever that building an enduring great company, one that is truly worthy of lasting, is a noble cause. And now we turn to Built to Last.
Chapter 1, The Best of the Best. This isn't a book about charismatic visionary leaders. It's not about visionary product concepts or visionary market insights. Nor even is it about just having a corporate vision. This is a book about visionary companies. What is a visionary company? Visionary companies are premier institutions, the crown jewels in their industries, widely admired by their peers, and having a long track record of making a significant impact on the world around them. All individual leaders eventually die, and all visionary products and services, all great ideas, eventually become obsolete. Yet visionary companies prosper over long periods of time through multiple product life cycles and multiple generations of leaders. In a 6-year project conducted at the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, we set out to identify and systematically research the historical development of a set of visionary companies to examine how they differed from a carefully selected control set of comparison companies, and to thereby discover the underlying factors that account for their extraordinary long-term position. We wish to be right up front. The comparison companies in our study are not dog companies, nor are they entirely unvisionary. Indeed, they are good companies, having survived in most cases as long as the visionary companies, and as you'll see, having outperformed the general stock market. But they didn't quite match up to the overall stature of the visionary companies in our study. In most cases, you can think of the visionary company as the gold medalist and the comparison company as a silver or bronze medalist. We chose the term visionary companies rather than just successful or enduring companies to reflect the fact that they have distinguished themselves as a very special and elite breed of institution. They are more than successful. They are more than enduring. In most cases, they are the best of the best in their industries and have been that way for decades. Many of them have served as role models, icons really, for the practice of management around the world. We'll come in a few minutes to how we identified the companies, but here is the complete list of companies in our study. Visionary Company, 3M. Comparison, Norton. Visionary Company, American Express. Comparison, Wells Fargo. Visionary Company, Boeing. Comparison, McDonnell Douglas. Visionary Company, Citicorp. Comparison, Chase Manhattan. Visionary Company, Ford. Comparison, GM. Visionary Company, General Electric. Comparison, Westinghouse. Visionary company, Hewlett-Packard. Comparison, Texas Instruments. Visionary company, IBM. Comparison, Burroughs. Visionary company, Johnson & Johnson. Comparison, Bristol-Myers Squibb. Visionary company, Marriott. Comparison, Howard Johnson. Visionary company, Merck. Comparison, Pfizer. Visionary company, Motorola. Comparison, Zenith. Visionary company, Nordstrom. Comparison, Melville. Visionary company, Philip Morris. Comparison, RJR Nabisco. Visionary company, Procter & Gamble. Comparison, Colgate. Visionary company, Sony. Comparison, Kenwood. Visionary company, Walmart. Comparison, Ames. Visionary company, Walt Disney. Comparison, Columbia Pictures. Yet, as extraordinary as they are, the visionary companies do not have perfect, unblemished records. Walt Disney faced a serious cash flow crisis in 1939, which forced it to go public. Later in the early 1980s, the company nearly ceased to exist as an independent entity as corporate raiders eyed its depressed stock price. In early 2004, it showed signs of struggle again as it faced unhappy shareholders and yet another hostile takeover bid. Boeing had serious difficulties in the mid-1930s, the late 1940s, and again in the early 1970s when it laid off over 60,000 employees. And again in 2003, the company struggled to keep up with the onslaught from Airbus. Sony had repeated product failures during its first 5 years of life, 1945 to 1950, and in the 1970s saw its beta format lose to VHS in the battle for market dominance in VCRs. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Sony shares have struggled behind the market. Ford posted one of the largest annual losses in American business history, $3.3 billion in 3 years, in the early 1980s, before it began an impressive turnaround and long-needed revitalization. Citibank, founded in 1812, the same year Napoleon marched on Moscow, languished in the late 1800s, during the 1930s depression, and again in the late 1980s when it struggled with its global loan portfolio. IBM was nearly bankrupt in 1914, then again in 1921, and again in the early 1990s. Indeed, all of the visionary companies in our study faced setbacks and made mistakes at some point during their lives. Yet, and this is a key point, visionary companies display a remarkable resiliency to bounce back from adversity. It is not the absence of difficulty that makes a visionary company, but the ability to struggle and eventually rebound back to greatness that is the signature of a truly great institution. As a result, visionary companies attain extraordinary long-term performance. Suppose you made equal $1 investments in a general market stock fund, a comparison company stock fund, and a visionary company stock fund on January 1, 1926. If you reinvested all dividends and made appropriate adjustments for when the companies became available on the stock exchange, your $1 in the general market fund would have grown to $415 on December 31, 1990, the year we cut off the data on our research study. Your $1 invested in the group of comparison companies would have grown to $955, more than twice the general market. But your $1 in the visionary company stock fund would have grown to $6,356, over six times the comparison fund and over 15 times the general market. Yet, the remarkable long-term financial performance of visionary companies diverts us from a key point of our work. Built to Last is not primarily about business performance. Built to Last is about building companies that change the world they touch and that weave themselves into the very fabric of society. Imagine how different the world would have looked and felt without Scotch tape or 3M Post-it notepads, the Ford Model T and Mustang, the Boeing 707 and 747, American Express cards, ATM machines pioneered on a wide scale by Citicorp, Johnson & Johnson Band-Aids and Tylenol, General Electric light bulbs, IBM computers, Marriott hotels, Motorola cellular phones, Sony Walkmans. Think of how many kids and adults grew up with Disneyland, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and Snow White. For better or worse, these companies have made an indelible imprint on the world around them. The exciting thing is to figure out why these companies have separated themselves into the special category that we consider highly visionary. How did they begin? How did they manage the various difficult stages of corporate evolution from tiny startups to global institutions? And once they became large, what characteristics did they share in common that distinguished them from other large companies? What can we learn from their development that might prove useful to people who would like to create, build, and maintain such companies? As a preview of our findings, here are a number of myths undercut by our research. Myth: it takes a great idea to start a great company. Reality: starting a company with a great idea might be a bad idea. Few of the visionary companies began life with a great idea. In fact, some began life without any specific idea, and a few even began with outright failures. Myth: visionary companies require charismatic visionary leaders. Reality: a charismatic visionary leader is absolutely not required for a visionary company, and in fact can be detrimental to a company's long-term prospects. Myth: the most successful companies exist to maximize profits. Reality: visionary companies pursued a cluster of objectives, of which making money is only one, and not necessarily the primary one. Yes, they seek profits, but they're equally guided by core values and sense of purpose beyond just making money. Myth: blue chip companies play it safe. Reality: visionary companies may appear straight-laced and conservative to outsiders, but they're not afraid to make bold commitments to big, hairy, audacious goals. BHAGs. Myth: visionary companies are great places to work for everyone. Reality: only those who fit extremely well with the core values and demanding standards of a visionary company will find it a great place to work. If you go to work at a visionary company, you will either fit and flourish, probably couldn't be happier, or you'll likely be ejected like a virus. Myth: companies need outside CEOs to stimulate fundamental change. Reality: going for outside CEOs is negatively correlated with positive and sustainable change. If your company needs fundamental change, it's more likely to succeed with an internally selected leader than by lurching after a savior CEO from the outside. The research study. Our research in Built to Last consisted of 5 basic steps. Step 1. Selecting the study set. We surveyed a carefully selected representative sample of 700 CEOs from both large and small companies, public and private. We received a 23.5% response rate from the CEOs and performed a series of statistical analyses to confirm that we received a geographically representative sample from all target populations. We selected the most frequently mentioned companies and then eliminated companies founded after 1950. We wanted to ensure that the company had a long enough track record to qualify as an enduring great company, not simply a single great product or a single remarkable leader. Step 2. Compared to what? We could have simply put the visionary companies off in a corral by themselves, studied them, and asked, what common characteristics do we see across these companies? But what would we find if we just looked for common characteristics? Just to use an extreme example, we would discover that all 18 of the companies have buildings. We would also find a perfect 100% correlation between being a visionary company and having desks, and pay systems, and boards of directors, and accounting systems, and, well, you get the idea. We agree that it would be absurd to then conclude that a key factor in being a visionary company is to have buildings. Indeed, all companies have buildings. So discovering that 100% of the visionary companies have buildings tells us nothing valuable. Suppose you study a group of successful companies and you find that they emphasize customer focus, or quality improvement, or empowerment. How do you know that you haven't merely discovered the management practice equivalent of having buildings? How do you know that you've discovered something that distinguishes the successful companies from other companies? You don't know. You can't know. Not unless you have a control set, a comparison group. The critical question is not what's common across a group of companies. Rather, the critical question is, what's essentially different about these companies? What distinguishes one set of companies from another? Step 3. Studying history and evolution, from startups to great companies. We didn't just ask, what attributes do these companies have today? Just looking at the visionary versus comparison companies in current time would be like merely watching the last 30 seconds of a marathon foot race. Sure, you could see who won the gold medal, but you wouldn't understand why he or she had won. To fully understand the outcome of a race, you have to see the entire race and the events that led up to it, to look at the various runners during their training, during their pre-race preparations, during mile 1, mile 2, mile 3, and so on. We therefore elected to look at the entire history of these companies, from their very founding through their adolescence and into becoming some of the largest companies in the world. While the final study set are large companies today, the bulk of our research focused on their early developmental years when they were small to mid-sized companies. The question is, why do these small, cash-strapped startup companies eventually become some of the most significant institutions in the world? What separated them from the others? And what concepts and frameworks can be developed to help others who would like to become in the 21st century what these companies were to the 20th century? Step 4. Crates of data, months of coding, and tortoise hunting. Throughout our research, we kept in mind the image of Charles Darwin taking his 5-year voyage on the HMS Beagle, exploring the Galapagos Islands and stumbling across huge tortoises, among other species, that varied from island to island. These unexpected observations planted a seed that provoked his thinking during his ride home on the Beagle and during his subsequent work in England. Darwin had the opportunity to gain new insights in part because he had the good fortune of unexpected observations. He wasn't looking specifically for variations in tortoises, yet there they were, these big, waddling, weird-looking tortoises wandering around the islands and not fitting neatly into prior assumptions about species. We, too, wanted to stumble into a few unexpected, weird-looking tortoises that might provoke our thinking. Of course, we wanted to be much more systematic than just wandering around aimlessly, hoping to randomly bump into a tortoise or two. To ensure systematic and comprehensive data collection, we employed a framework based on a technique called organization stream analysis for collecting and sorting information. Using this framework, our research team gathered and tracked 9 categories of information over the entire history of each company. To gather information for 36 separate companies over an average lifespan of 90-plus years, we sourced nearly 100 books and over 3,000 individual documents, articles, case studies, archive materials, corporate publications, and video footage. As a conservative estimate, we reviewed over 60,000 pages of material. The actual number is probably closer to 100,000 pages. The documents for this project fill 3-shoulder-height file cabinets, 4 bookshelves, and 20 megabytes of computer storage space for financial data and analyses. It is important to understand that we developed all the concepts in this work by making empirical deductions directly from the data. We did not begin this project with a theory to test or prove. We sought to build a theory from the ground up, derived directly from the evidence. Step 5, building a framework. Next came the most difficult task of the entire project. We distilled the nearly overwhelming amount of information, much of it qualitative, down to a few key concepts linked together in a framework, a set of conceptual hooks on which to hang and organize the rich detail and supporting evidence from our research. And this is what the rest of this book is all about. The underlying backbone of our findings comes from comparison analyses. Throughout our work, we kept coming back to the primary question: what separates the visionary companies from the comparison companies over the long course of history? We cannot claim to have truth with a capital T, but we do claim that the key ideas we discovered are well supported by the data collected and analyzed in our 6 years of research, and we remain confident that the core ideas will continue to prove useful to anyone who seeks to turn great results into an enduring great company that makes a distinctive impact on the world it touches. So we invite you to join us on an intellectual adventure. We encourage you to question and challenge. We offer everything herein for your thoughtful consideration, not blind acceptance. You're the judge and jury. Let the evidence speak.
Chapter 2. Clock building, not time telling. Imagine you met a remarkable person that could look up at the sun, the stars, any time of day or night, and state the exact time and date. It's April 23rd, 1401, 2:36 a.m., and 12 seconds. Now, this would be an amazing time teller, We'd probably revere this person for the ability to tell time. But wouldn't that person be even more amazing if instead of telling time, he or she built a clock that could tell the time forever, even after he or she is gone? Having a great idea, or being a charismatic visionary leader, is what we call time-telling. But building a company that can prosper far beyond the presence of any single leader and through multiple product life cycles, well, that's what we call clock building. In the first pillar of our findings, and the subject of this chapter, we demonstrate how the builders of visionary companies tend to be clock builders, not time tellers. These leaders concentrate primarily on building an organization, building a ticking clock rather than on hitting a market just right with a visionary product idea or riding the growth curve of an attractive product life cycle. The primary output of their efforts is not the tangible implementation of a great idea, the expression of a great and towering charismatic visionary personality, the gratification of their ego, the accumulation of personal wealth. No, their greatest creation is the company itself and what it stands for. Let me share with you one of our favorite myths to fall from our research, and that's the myth of the great idea. On August 23, 1937, two recently graduated engineers in their early 20s, with no substantial business experience, met to discuss the founding of a new company. But the problem was, they didn't have any clear idea of what the company would make. They only knew that they wanted to start a company with each other in the broadly defined field of electronic engineering. They brainstormed a wide range of initial product and market possibilities, but they had no compelling, great idea that served as the founding inspiration of the fledgling company. All they knew is they wanted to work together. What they would make, that would be determined later. Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard decided first to start a company, and then they would figure out what to make. They just started moving forward, trying anything that might get them out of the garage and pay the light bills. According to Bill Hewlett, "When I talk to business schools occasionally, the professor of management is just devastated when I say that we didn't have any plans when we started. We were just opportunistic. We did anything that would bring in a nickel. We had a bowling foul line indicator, a clock drive for a telescope, a thing to make a urinal flush automatically, and a shock machine to make people lose weight. Here we were with about $500 in capital, trying whatever someone thought we might be able to do." Well, the bowling foul line indicator didn't become a market revolution. The automatic urinal flushers and the fat reduction shock machines, they didn't really go anywhere either. In fact, the company stumbled along for nearly a year before it got its first big sale. 8 audio oscilloscopes to Walt Disney for work on the movie Fantasia. It's interesting to look over to the comparison company to HP, which is Texas Instruments, which in contrast traces its roots to a highly successful initial concept. TI began life in 1930 as Geophysical Services Incorporated, the first independent company to make reflection seismograph surveys of potential oil fields, and its Texas labs developed and produced instruments for such work. TI's founders, unlike Hewlett and Packard, formed their company to exploit a specific technological and market opportunity. They knew what they were going to do. TI started with a great idea. HP did not. Neither did Sony. When Masaru Obuka founded his company in August of 1945, he had no specific product idea. In fact, Obuka and his 7 initial employees had a brainstorming session after starting the company to decide what products to make. They considered a wide range of possibilities, from sweetened bean paste soup to miniature golf equipment and slide rules. Not only that, Sony's first product attempt, which was a simple rice cooker, failed to work properly, and its first significant product, which was a tape recorder, failed in the marketplace. The company kept itself alive in the early days by stitching wires on cloth to make crude but sellable heating pads. Like Obuka and Hewlett, Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, also started without a great idea. He went into business with nothing other than the desire to work for himself and a little bit of knowledge and one heck of a lot of passion about retailing. Walton didn't wake up one day and say, "I have this great idea around which I'm going to start a company." Walton started in 1945 with a single Ben Franklin franchise five and dime store in the small town of Newport, Arkansas. Yes, a single dime store is the founding of Walmart. "I had no vision of the scope of what I would start, Walton commented in a New York Times interview. But I always had confidence that as long as we did our work and we were good to our customers, there would be no limit to us. Now, as I'm recording this in 2004, I would just like to make an interesting observation. From that start of Walmart in 1945, today, Walmart has become a company that if it continues the same growth rate over the next 10 years that it has done in the previous 10 years, Walmart will become the first $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, $1 trillion revenue company in the history of the world. It will have a GDP that roughly rivals the United Kingdom. It will have more employees than the entire United States federal government, including the military, combined. If you take all the products that have been shoplifted from Walmart in a given year and you set them aside and made that its own company, it would be in the Fortune 500. And all that from Sam Walton, who simply had no idea other than that he wanted to work for himself, and he started with a single dime store in Newport, Arkansas. How did Walton do this? He did it incrementally, step by step, from that single store until the great idea of rural discount popped out as a natural evolutionary step, almost 2 decades after he started his company. He himself wrote in the book Made in America, "Somehow over the years, folks have gotten the impression that Walmart was something I dreamed up out of the blue as a middle-aged man, and that it was just this great idea that turned into an overnight success. But our first Walmart store was totally an outgrowth of everything we'd been doing since 1945. Another case of me being unable to leave well enough alone. Another experiment. And like most overnight successes, it was about 20 years in the making." HP, Sony, Walmart, three of the most significant companies in the 20th century, and none of them began with a great idea. They put a huge dent in the widely held mythology of corporate origins, a mythology that paints a picture of a far-seeing entrepreneur founding his or her company to capitalize on a visionary product idea or a visionary market insight. This myth holds that those who launch highly successful companies usually begin first and foremost with a brilliant idea, and then they ride the growth curve of an attractive product lifecycle. Yet this mythology, as compelling and pervasive as it is, does not show up as a general pattern in the founding of the visionary companies. Not only did some of these great companies get started without a great idea, some of them began life like Sony, with outright failures. 3M started as a failed mine, leaving 3M investors holding stock that fell to the barroom exchange value of 2 shares for 1 shot of cheap whiskey. Not knowing what else to do, the company began making sandpaper. Bill Boeing, the founder of Boeing Corporation, well, his first airplane failed. It was a handmade, clumsy seaplane copied from a Martin seaplane, and it flunked its Navy trials. And his company faced such difficulty during his first few years of operation that it entered, of all things, the furniture business to keep itself aloft. Walt Disney. Do you realize that Walt Disney's first cartoon series was called Alice in Cartoonland? And it languished in theaters. Disney biographer Richard Schickel wrote that it was by and large a limp, dull, and cliché-ridden enterprise. All you could really say for it was that it was a fairly ordinary comic strip set in motion and enlivened by a photographic trick. When we completed our research and looked back at the founding of the companies, we found that only 3 of the visionary companies began life with the benefit